Very good. Oh my goodness. This bag smokes heavy tonight.
Oh my goodness me. Oh, not bad. Okie dokie. Let's see what we got tonight. The first question. Dear Ajahn, how to encourage my friend to meditate more? You've got to meditate first. And when you can meditate, then when you can meditate really well, then you have these psychic powers. You just look at your friend and you force them to meditate. So, in other words, you can't encourage other people to meditate well unless you're meditating well. And that's one of the best ways to show how wonderful this is, if it changes your life. And people look at you and say, wow, you're so more peaceful than you were before. And of course, that encourages them to meditate. And at the same time, if you go back after this retreat and you're a pain in the backside to the people you live with, that's not going to encourage them to go meditate, is it? So if it works for you and you're wiser, more peaceful and kinder, that's the best way to encourage others. What is a good side of being unwell? It's a great teaching if you're unwell. Number one, you realize you're not in control of your body. Your body gets sick in the most inconvenient times, usually on the weekends. It'd be much better to be sick on Monday when you can take time off work. But anyway, what is the good side of being unwell? What it does, it teaches you just how important it is that you're not in control of your body, that you have to work with your body. And sometimes that nature is the boss. Sometimes I used to tell myself that, you know, who owns this body which bears my name? It's not me. Sometimes I say, you own it. Because you tell me what to do, eat this, eat that, exercise. I've got no freedom. Nah, because I've got lots of freedom. But it's not you who own the body, it's not me who own the body. Sometimes I remember it's nature who owns my body. And so, you know, if it's sick, you have to let it be sick. And if it's healthy, you let it be healthy. And sometimes you don't know which one it's going to be. So if you are unwell, you learn so much. You learn how to let go of the body. Another thing with being unwell, there's sometimes, I mentioned this story, I don't know if it was to you or to the monks the other day, that when I was really sick with a cold, when I was a student, and all the other people in the house where I was staying with, they all went off to the university that day, and I just was in bed, didn't even get up, didn't even just change from my pyjamas to any other clothes. I felt really terrible, sneezing and stuff coming out of, you know, my nose and stuff. And then the doorbell rang. And, you know, somebody was knocking on the door, so I dragged myself up. I didn't want to go at all. And when I got to the door, there was a gentleman there who had a parcel for me. And I realized it was my hi-fi system. Now, these are old days, okay? If you want to listen to music, you have all these boxes you've got to connect together. And it was my hi-fi system. And so, you know, I had a quick boost of energy, said thank you, and signed the paper, and then took it up to my room and managed to unpack everything, connect it all together. And by the time my first LP went on, Jimi Hendrix, I could play as loud as I wanted because no other students were in the house at the time. They were doing what they're supposed to be doing, studying. And as soon as I put the first record on, I realised my cold had gone. It just wasn't there anymore. Illness is weird. Where did it go? I don't know. So you're unwell. But I don't get cold so much these days. A bit of hay fever maybe. But sometimes what you do get as monks and nuns as well is indigestion, because you don't really know what you're eating. You see something. This happened to me over in, it was in Canada, because my tummy these days cannot take any spicy food. And apparently the people who, when I was in Canada, was going to their house for a meal, they called Ajahn Bamali up and said, what does Ajahn Brahm like to eat? What can he eat? And they said, I don't mind saying this, said some shepherd's pie. And so I went to the Sri Lankan people's house, they had lots of the usual Sri Lankan curries and dal and stuff, and they had some shepherd's pie. I thought, wow, I can eat something today. Mm-hmm. And I put this big spoon of shepherd's pie in my bowl. And only then I realised that, yeah, it was potato on the top, but underneath was spicy curry. Oh, well. It looked the real thing until you actually had to put it in your bowl and eat it. Oh, well. But so sometimes you do get indigestion as a monk, and because, you know, you can't control your food so much. But on this time, this was the time, I haven't told this story, I usually tell it every retreat, when I had, it was food poisoning. This was not just indigestion. This is when your tummy cramps up and it's very, very painful. And I go, ah! I usually, you know, tell this story just during talks when I see people about to fall asleep because, you know, they're getting a bit bored. And I go, ah! Well, there's kids there. The kids are like, ah! The kids may not understand the meaning of the story, but they like me going, ah! And it was in my cave. And when I was in my cave there, it was a waste of time because people can't hear me. So I was screaming in my cave, thinking, what could I do next? But, you know how to meditate. So, and this, you know, I don't know when I last told a story to you, probably yesterday, I'm not sure. But anyway, was it yesterday? No, first day, no. I tell this very often. It's a great story because it's real, it's powerful. So I was in such agony, you know, these were automatic screams. You couldn't really do much about it. Ah! But then I decided, okay, let's do the meditation. Now's the most important time. What you're experiencing is the most important thing in the whole world. I wasn't trying to reject it anymore. I was giving it respect, you know, the pain and the contractions. And my whole attitude was to be kind, not to try and cure it, to care for it. And this is where people make a lot of mistakes in life. They get some sickness and they try and cure it. And it makes it worse, too much stress and tension. So I just cared for my pain. And it was very clear, because this was such a wonderful experience. I remember it very clearly. I mean, sometimes the timing, I don't know if it was 20 minutes or 40 minutes, it was one of those two. So let's be positive and call it 20 minutes. Every time the intestines or bowels contracted really painfully, that, you know, you notice that, and instead of reacting with, it was just with some kindness to it. It's okay, you're just doing what you have to do. And I wasn't trying to resist it at all. And the amazing thing happened was after just a couple of minutes, the contraction was slightly less painful, maybe only 90% of the pain it was beforehand. It was very clear because you were aware, mindful, you know, it was actually something was happening. And then it got a bit less painful, a little less painful, and it just carried on like that, getting less and less painful with every contraction until you had the last contraction and then everything was fine again. And there was no indigestion afterwards either. There was no stomach contractions or anything. And so it was amazing to see how that would work. You had very intense pain 1 minute and 20 minutes later it had all gone. And it's wonderful to be able to do that, because it means you don't have to take all the medications and go to hospitals and stuff like that. But afterwards, I always started to contemplate, how did that happen? Because when you have great experiences, you always try and figure it out afterwards. Why? What happened? And because I know that when you have food poisoning, it's some bacteria in your tummy are just going crazy in there. And then I thought, ah, I know what they've done. I imagine all these bacteria, you know, because all these bacteria, there's little feelers coming out of them. I imagine all of those, you know, spindles of whatever it was coming out of the globular shape, they all were crossing their legs and crossing their arms and sitting quietly meditating in my gut. And that's what I visualised, and I thought that's why they were nice and quiet. They weren't causing me any problem anymore. I'd say, bacteria, just calm down. Just cross your legs, cross your arms, and just... I don't know, do they breathe, bacteria? I don't know what they do, but just, you know, be calm, be peaceful. And that was the end of it. So, you know, you learn a lot from sort of being unwell. Sometimes the fear of it is what makes it worse. Oh, I'm going to die. Oh, it's going to get worse. Oh. That you can do something about, because not even doctors really know what's going to happen next. You know, they can sort of, you know, the way it looks like this is what's going to happen next, but there's too many times in people's lives the doctors have been confused. He didn't die. And what was that? Now, I mentioned chanting earlier. Did I tell the chanting story about that old Chinese man in hospital? Okay. There was... I give so many talks, not just here, but when I go over to Bodhinyana. This was a case when I was... gave a phone call. There was an elderly Chinese man in ICU in Rawpurse dying. And the family wanted me to go there immediately because, you know, didn't have much time left. So I'm a pretty amenable monk, so I got the car, went in there, and went into the ICU. You know, I had to pretty rush to go in there. I should have asked more questions before I went into the ICU. So I just went in there and did my thing. It was really nice nice chanting. When I really want to, I can really just do some really sort of powerful chanting. I really gave everything I got, and the guy opened his eyes. He came out of the coma. And even the doctors were quite surprised that he was going to live. And so when I went out there, you know, feeling happy and good about myself and told the relations that, you know, the elderly gentleman is going to survive, they got very angry at me. They come from so many different countries overseas to be with the elderly gentleman in his last, you know, few days. And apparently they'd even arranged a funeral service, you know, with the funeral director, and they'd chosen the coffin and the plots and everything. And this this Western monk comes along and messes it all up by making it better. And they were really upset. They said, well, we're going to have to come back later on anyway when he dies properly, but now you've wasted all our time, wasted a lot of money. So we never got any donations from those people. But what I did get, I learned a very important lesson. Now, there are many different types of chanting. So whenever I go to visit anybody in the ICU or in a hospital, I always ask them, first of all, what type of chanting do you want? The die peaceful chant or the get better chant? They're different. It's not my fault. And yeah, that is a pretty accurate story, believe it or not. I had some great fun as a monk. Okay. The next one, question. That's only the first question, crikey. Hi Ajahn, chanting more and meditate more, which one is better? They are both better. Do you understand? Chanting more or meditating more? That's both okay. So in other words, sometimes, can you meditate 24 hours a day? How long can you meditate? And sometimes we think, oh, meditation's a bit dull, so you do some chanting. Oh, you quieten the chanting down and do more meditating. So, now, which is better, just rice or potato or bread? You have a bit of each. And it depends on what you want today. Today is like a rice day. Tomorrow's noodles. Which is better? Noodles or rice? Both are better. So, but don't just think just chant and no meditation. Chanting is quite easy, really. And these days, sometimes you don't even need to do chanting. They have these little machines you put by people's bedside and do the chant all the time. In that, you know, especially when people are dying. If they put that by me when I was very sick, I'd die very quickly just to get suddenly crazy, want a bit of peace. Because they are so quite noisy. You know, that for me, I like peace and quiet. That's why I think that you notice here, I hope, that there's so many moments in Jhana Grove here. You're by yourself, and it's so quiet. No sound of any traffic on the road. There's no aircraft overhead. There's a few birds. And there's sometimes there's no wind. And you listen, there's no sound at all. And those times of stillness and peace are just magic. I love the music of silence more than anything else. And chanting, you don't need chanting then. It's done its job. But because I've, you know, been a monk a long time, all these chants, I know their meanings. And I still recall this one chant. I never do it anymore. And the reason is it was too powerful for me. It was a chant of spreading loving kindness and also Karuna, Mudita, Upeka, the four balm we harvest. I remember when Ajahn Jaco was the abbot, we used to chant that in the evening. And when I was chanting, I was focusing on the words, what the words meant. And he got halfway through the first of these, and I was just blissing out. I was actually doing. Well, not just chanting it, just doing it. May all beings be happy and well. The first quarter, the second quarter, the third quarter, and my mind just was spreading loving kindness everywhere. And it's very powerful for me. I could really connect with that to the point that I couldn't finish the chant. I went silent. And the second part, the third verse, the fourth verse, I never chanted. It was just too powerful, the first verse. It's wonderful when those things happen because it's teaching you to do something and you're not just listening to the words, you're actually following the instructions. And they're really, really nice and very powerful. So I just, with the best will in the world, I just can't do that chant. It's too much for me. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, what are the best ways of achieving a work-life balance in a stressful job like being a monk? Oh no, sorry. Is being a monk a stressful job? You bet it is, because if I don't do a good job, you won't come and feed me. I've got no other ways of living. You know, I don't have any savings in the bank. I don't have any superannuation. I don't have any superannuation at all. I've got no pension, nothing. It's very stressful. If I say something wrong or bad, then you don't feed me, I'm in big trouble. That's why, you know, out of fear, I always keep a bit of a supply here just in case. This is not fear. Sorry, no, let's be serious, if I can. What are the best ways of achieving a work-life balance in a stressful job through meditation practice? Something noticed my handwriting has improved after 4 days of meditation. Yeah. Oh, meditation is brilliant. And this is the story. If you haven't seen this before, I don't know where you've been, but this was, I don't know where I first did it. I think I first did this in a computer conference over in Brisbane. It was, they got this World Computer Conference or something, and they invited me there just to give a little presentation. It went really well. It went so well, I got to, I was only doing a little side thing. Then I got into the national conference. And then, it was about 3 years ago, I really scored this really nice gig. And it was to the World Computer Congress. And I was down to give the keynote address. And it was in Daejeon in South Korea. That was a really good gig when I got the invitation. It was to give the keynote address at the World Computer Conference. And the other monk said, what are you doing that for? We always have to help you when you get into trouble with your little laptop. You haven't done much about computing at all. I said, yeah, that's where I want to go. And they paid business class fares all the way to Seoul. And they put me in a really nice 5-star hotel. And they were just so impressed, they gave, a $2,000 donation to the monastery afterwards. Oh, yeah, it's really good. I'll do that again. But the most important thing was just, like, fun. So what am I going to a World Computer Conference for? And giving the keynote address. And all these people from all these big shots from these big companies. I remember one fellow there, he was the head of the European security, the cyber security, to stop people actually getting into, hacking into other people's, you know, government emails accounts, and all these big shots from the CEOs of all these companies. And when you go to this conference and you give the keynote address, yeah, right, the host, first of all, welcomes everybody, and then the president, they do all these formal things, and then they have the first speaker in the plenary session to everybody in this big hall was me. And when I came up there, you could see people looking around. Who is this? What's he doing here? I'm a monk. Not an IT nerd. So anyway, then I sort of told them that whenever you have any conferences, one of the most important things is to get something a little bit different, off-centre, not what you expect. Because if you want to get some expert, you can read that in a book, or you can go on sort of YouTube or something, you can hear it directly. The point of having a conference is hearing something a little bit different. And I remember giving this was one of the stories. And this is answering this question, by the way. How heavy is my cup of water? And the answer is, many of you heard this before, like all my jokes. How heavy is this cup of water? The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. After 1 minute, my arm is aching. After 2 minutes, my arm is in pain. After 10 minutes, I'm a very stupid monk. Why should I keep holding this when it gets too heavy to hold comfortably? It doesn't make sense. So when it gets a bit too heavy to hold comfortably, what do? You put it down and rest. And it's a very simple experiment. You can do this in your rooms afterwards to prove it to yourself. After just 30 seconds of rest, I pick it up again. It actually feels lighter. It's exactly the same weight, but because my arm is rested, it feels lighter. You can hold it now without any aches and pains. That is stress in the workplace, explained and the solution given to you. You've got a job to do, some decisions to make, something to write, and you're tired, and your brain is just reacting, it doesn't want to do it, and it feels heavier and heavier and heavier. And all you need to do is just put it down for a few minutes. Rest. But I can't afford a few minutes. I've got a deadline. Put it down for a few minutes. Because then afterwards, when your brain has rested, you find you're efficient. Ideas come up. Handwriting is clearer. Sort of, you can write sentences quicker. Your productivity goes up after you've rested. And so that's the way to deal with workplace stress. When you're tired, rest. 10 minutes of rest. Or this was eventually taken up, apparently, in Harvard Business School. And to make it more accessible for those in a place like Harvard Business School, they called it an investment of time. An investment that just, you know, clicks with people who are into business. If you give 10 minutes or half an hour of resting, it's an investment. You're not getting anything out of that half an hour, but you're investing it. And it means the next 2 hours you get 3 hours work done of high quality. So simple. And that's how you overcome stress. And it also means that when you go back home after a busy day, you don't get upset and angry at your wife and kids. This is one of my favourite stories, but it's a sad story, but it's very common in our modern world.
about the father who came home from work. And he came late because he had a very busy day. And his son was waiting for him at the door. And as the father let himself in, his son said, "Daddy, how much do you earn at work?" He said, "Be quiet, son, I've had a very busy day." "Daddy, how many dollars do you earn at work?" "Look, I told you, son, I'm just really tired and stressed out. I just want a bit of a break." "Daddy, how many dollars do you earn every hour at work?" "I told you 3 times. Go up to your room." And so he grounded his son, just asking a very simple question. And you've probably done that sometimes because you're tired and you haven't got any energy. And thinking, why does a son, 6 or 7 years of age, why does he want to know that? So anyway, the father had a cup of tea or coffee or something, and they started feeling guilty. You know, he only got angry with his son because he was tired, exhausted, stressed out after a busy day. So he went out to his son's room, let himself in, and said, "Son, I don't know why you want to know this, but I earn $20 an hour at my office. $20 an hour." And the son smiled and said, "Thank you, Daddy. Now, can I please borrow $10? And the father, he got angry with his son once. He's not going to get angry again. So he took out his wallet and took out a $10 note, gave it to his son. "Here you are, son." And the son opened his bedside drawer and took out another $10 in coins, counted out 20, gave it to his father, said, "Daddy, can I now please have 1 hour of your time?" You understand that? I remember this when I was in Sulawesi. I had to give an interview, and there was a Muslim lady, and she burst out crying when I told that story. Because, you know, she had a son. She was a single mum. And she had a son, and she was working so hard to try and, you know, get enough to give the son a good start in life. But she understood straight away what the son really needed was his mum, an hour with them. So that's actually work-life balance, what's really important. That story, you know, really shows just what kids really need. And by taking a rest or by playing with your son when you come home and spending time with them, your work actually gets much better. You feel less stressed and less worry. So that's one of the reasons why. If you're tired... Oh, no, what is this story? This is... In the first book which I wrote, the Opening the Door of Your Heart book, about the... I saw this. All these stories which, you know, sometimes I invent these stories, and I find they go round and round and round and round. And until this one over here about the cup, it was some meeting, and a politician was opening this meeting in Perth. And... Oh, there was falling off my chair laughing. I think it was just the member for Perth, Evangelina Evangeloni or something. But anyway, she came up and she gave her little speech, welcome everybody. And she said, "I heard this from a wise man who once told me," he said, "a cup is only heavy because you keep holding it." And I went, "Oh, that's my simile. I told that years ago." He said, "Oh, I don't care," she said. But I was very happy. It went round and round and round. You know, people actually were listening to it and practicing it. So it was really nice. But anyway, what am I doing? So if you can just take rest during the day, you find your ability to do your work is much improved. That's the right life-work balance. Ajahn, if right stillness is part of the Eightfold Path of Nirvana, does it mean that someone like Mother Teresa, despite all her selfless kind deeds, will never become enlightened as long as she does not practice meditation and enter jhanas? Did she enter jhanas? Unlikely, but never know. But basically, yeah. Very kind, gets great sort of rebirths. Very inspiring person. But can you be kind enough to your own body and mind, as well as to others? Sometimes we see people who sacrifice themselves so much, but they're missing an important point in life. Kindness to yourself. To understand that story, the seven monks meditating in a cave. How many haven't heard that? I mean, be honest. The seven monks meditating in a cave. Oh, Mahinda, you've heard that before, but maybe you're getting old now, so.
I know Mahinda, he just doesn't want to hope.
Anyway, seven monks meditating in a cave on loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be free of suffering. You know, all just a loving kindness thing. And then this band of thieves and robbers found that cave in the jungle, and they just wanted to take that cave over for themselves because it was an excellent location. It was so well hidden. And they could do their robberies and stealing whatever, and they could put all the guilds in the cave and just hide there until the police forgot about them. It's a great hideout for them. Only one problem. The monks were there. So the head of the thieves wanted to murder, kill, slaughter every one of the monks so they wouldn't say where the cave was located. And the head monk, he was a really good talker. If he wasn't a monk, he could have been a prime minister of Australia or a used car salesman, one of the two. Please excuse me. And he managed to convince the head of the thieves to let all the monks go except one. One would have to be killed in front of all the other monks to prove that these thieves were serious. And if any one of the surviving monks told the police where this cave was, the thieves would come for them and do the same to them. Had to be a warning. And that's the best the head monk could do. So the head monk, all the responsibilities of being a head monk, the stress of having to choose who would die so all the rest could survive. And so, in a few moments, I'm going to ask you, if you were the head monk, who would you choose? Are you sure I didn't tell this story the first day? Second day? Okay. Told it somewhere recently. And so, the seven monks in the cave, listen carefully who they were, and then you can make your choice. The first was the head monk himself. The second was his brother. You know, they'd become monks together. They were so close together. They'd do anything for each other. Same, the third monk was his best friend. And they're like friends. Again, if it's my mate, you just do anything for your friends. Even sacrifice your life so your friend can be free. Fourth monk was the enemy. Even monks sometimes have personality clashes. So the fourth monk was the enemy, always causing a bit of trouble. The fifth monk was a very old monk. He was so old, he could die any day. And the next monk was a very sick monk. And his illness was, you know, he wasn't that old, but he was so sick that no one knew who would die first, the old monk or the sick monk. They were both, you know, close to dying. And the last monk, number seven, was the useless monk. Every time they did chanting, he'd always chant off key. Every time they meditated, he'd be the first one to start snoring. So he was a useless monk. And I often say, every monastery has one. Because you kind of let everyone, you know, give them a chance to become a monk. And just... Anyway, what about the nuns? Do they have a useless nun in back in Dharamsala? Sorry? More than one. That's wonderful. So anyway, before you get yourself into trouble, because these ones are recorded, you know. So those seven monks, head monk, brother, best friend, enemy, old monk, sick monk, and useless monk, who would you choose? If you know the right answer, please be quiet, don't spoil it. Who do you reckon he chose? Nah, don't be scared. Who says the useless monk? He never done any good confession. Himself? Who thinks it was himself? Put your hand up. I thank you for putting your hand up because you're all wrong. I apologise. But the answer was, because I always run out of time, the answer was he was unable to choose. It was impossible for him to choose. Because his love towards his brother was exactly the same, no more, no less at all, than his love towards his best friend, his enemy, the old monk, the sick monk, the useless monk, and most importantly, he loved each one of those no more, no less than his love for himself. And I still recall in Sacramento, when I was over there once giving a talk, a Presbyterian bishop came to listen to my talk, and I couldn't resist telling that story. And of course, the bishop, you know, the Christian bishop, when he was asked, I asked him, who would you choose? He said, oh, you'd sacrifice yourself, of course. I said, wrong answer. And I reminded him, in the Bible, your Bible, doesn't it say to love your neighbour as yourself? Doesn't it say to love your neighbour more than yourself? And it was very good. He said, oh, yeah, I get it. He said, can I use that? And please use it in your next sermon. And it's one of the problems we have. We sacrifice ourselves in ways we never sort of hurt other people. So that was the answer. You couldn't choose. His love was so equal. So that is why, that if you love yourself as much as you love others, no more, no less, in fact, you look upon yourself as just another being in this world, then you find out that it's very easy to let go and be peaceful and get jhanas. If you love other people more than yourself, then you can't do it. I better do some more questions. Dear Ajahn, can I please know how a layperson can reach samadhi states through meditation practice? I'll answer that question at the very end of the retreat. The way they do it is with patience. Just wait, it happens. This was one of those very deep questions, nothing on it. Oh no, actually. There is a question on it. They put it in the front here, this drawing. What is the actual question here? It's just this guy looking at sort of a piece of... Is it paper or is it toilet paper? It looks like toilet paper to me. So what is the question here? Is a wise of toilet full? They can't go into use it. I don't know. Anyway. How can they reach samadhi states through meditation practice? Again, this is basically all I teach on retreats, how that works. Little by little, you've already given a lot of information. You see it here. And like the thousand petal lotus with awareness and kindness. That's all. Don't do too much. Don't make it complicated. One of the things which really impressed me when I started reading, you know, the suttas in the time of the Buddha, that sometimes the Buddha would give this very simple instruction to one monk or one nun or even a lay person. They wouldn't teach, you know, 1 hour every morning and hour question and answers in the evening and interviews if you want them during the rest of the day. It was one teaching for about 5 minutes. And they go off to their quiet places and they come back afterwards enlightened. It's amazing, isn't it? Because those simple teachings they had, they really focused on them, got them inside and practiced them and got very, very deep and very still. So, you just be mindful and kind. It's very simple. Onto your body, and the body relaxes and disappears, and you see this thing called time inside of you. Mindful and kind, and it's very quickly You come to the present moment awareness, mindful and kind, and then you're silent. And all these things are so wonderful, just silence. It's, you know, even though I've been a monk for many, many, many years, just silence is just so gorgeous. Now, I love it. Okay, I'm attached to silence, believe it or not. And when you hear it, when you feel it, you don't want to do anything. And then you get to your breath. Gorgeous breath going in, going out. You're just kind to your breath. You don't try and control it. You don't try and get rid of it. You're just kind to your breathing. And you're aware of it. The more kind you are, just the easier it is to be aware. You see much more of it. It becomes the long breath or the short breath, it becomes the whole of the breath. You see so much more what's going on. Then it becomes more beautiful. You see the delightful breath. You get so much happiness in the meditation, it's just there. You don't make it happen, you don't chase it away, because you're just being kind to what's happening. And soon you bliss out. And there's so much happiness inside that, you know, you're not really aware of your body. You're right inside and you get into these great nimitta states. And after the nimitta states, you just go inside of those and it's incredibly still. And that's called samadhi, sama samadhi. And sometimes, you know, you feel that when people achieve these for the first times, you're just a passenger on the journey. You don't do it. You just get out of the way and let it happen. And all the conditions are ripe. You're just sitting there and just, you don't say wow, but afterwards you say, whoa, whoa, whoa. And you're not responsible at all, you didn't do it, you got out of the way. You realise your will, choice, doing, think you have ability, you haven't got ability, that is all just hindrances. Okay. This is a sad question. It's not really a question. It's your Jack Russell was put down today, faithful companion for 18 years. So sad, we'll miss him so much. Have you lost him? Your dog? You haven't lost your dog. You've had him for 18 years. What a wonderful thing that was. You know, I've already mentioned the stories which I say about the concerts. 18-year-long concert with your dogs. Now it's finished. You'll never forget that. You thank you, dog. Thank you so much for all that love you gave us. And all those wonderful experiences you share together with your dog. So when those things happen, see if you can look upon it in a different way. Because it'll always be, and I'll just put this answer in as well, was put down today. In other words, euthanized. It's one of those questions, I think I did say this already, those questions for Buddhists, you take your dog or your cat to the vet, and the vet says it has to be put down, has to be euthanized. What do? You love the dog, you never want to see that dog suffer. But then again, you've got this precept of not killing animals. What do? And that's why the answer I mentioned earlier, you ask your dog, you ask your cat, it might be a little pet rabbit. You hold it and look in its eyes. Do you want to die yet? Are you ready? It's a very powerful and very beautiful moment. Sometimes, I never did this. We had this cat who had cancer on its nose. And, you know, because I was a boss, they said, what should we do, what should we do? I said, keep asking the cat. And the cat would never actually give an answer. And so right at the very end, I think it was Ajahn Santuti was holding it. And he said, have you had enough? Yeah, do you want to go to the vet? And he said, believe it or not, the cat shook its head, yes. So we took it to the vet. It was the cat's choice, not our choice. And the same with this other lady. You know, many of you know her. Remember Judy Rushforth? And she passed away now, but when she had a little dog and took it to the vet, and it had cancer. And the vet said, it has to be put down, it's suffering. She remembered my advice. So, can I have just a few moments with my dog? So she held the dog in a corner of the veterinary surgery and asked the question, do you want to go? Do you want to die? And she got a very clear answer back from the dog. I mean, not nodding its head or barking or anything, but she could feel, it's your dog, you've been with them for such a long time, you love them. She could feel the dog didn't want to be injected. So she took the dog back to the vet, you know, in the next room, and said, no, I'm taking my dog home. And the vet was really angry at her, she told me. You're supposed to be a Buddhist, you're supposed to be compassionate. That dog is suffering, it has to be put down. She said, no. So she took it home. And Judy took the dog back again 6 months later. It made a full recovery all by itself. And the vet said, you Buddhists are very wise. The dog knew. And that was just one case. Apparently many people have done that with their animals. And it works. If it's your pet, you know them. You ask the question, you feel the answer. And that intuition which you have, you know, no, it doesn't want to die yet. It's a dog's choice. It's a cat's choice. And sometimes dogs are wiser than people. Sometimes that dog was anyway. The vet thought it had no hope. But that dog made a total 100% recovery. Amazing. Anyway, yes, you miss your Jack Russell so much. But please, don't fill your heart with loss. Otherwise you can't enjoy anything in life. Instead, fill your heart with this wonderful sense of thank you. Thank you for being your dog for such a long time. And then you have lots of joy and happiness. Dear Ajahn, I've heard that many go through fear at the time of death. How does one learn and prepare to overcome this? Look, number one, if you just get a jhana, or it's even nimittas, that should tell you, it's so obvious that your mind is greater than the body and the body might die but the mind just keeps carrying on. At least you understand what death is. So you don't have to be afraid. And sometimes you think, yay! It's not you're afraid of death. Sometimes you start thinking that, how many days have I got left, doctor? He says, maybe about 2 weeks. He said, well, can't you just make it 1 week? You're going to die anyway. Why go through all the aches and pains of death when you know what's going to happen afterwards? So anyway, prepare to overcome this. What is the best to focus on at the time of death for someone going through the last stages? Something like clear comprehension. Just let go. It's only your body. You don't own your body. Body's not yours. When my body was young, it was fit and handsome and... which is my real body? None of these are. So just, it's not your body. It keeps on changing with the seasons. And so when it gets old, it's time to get a new one, isn't it? If you had an old washing machine, which was really sort of, you know, hardly working at all, consumed so much energy to keep going, how many of you would keep an old washing machine in your laundry, you know, when you get a new one? It's crazy to keep the old ones going. So when it's time, let go. When you don't have any fear, you can actually die much more peacefully, much quicker. It's amazing how the emotions keep the human being alive for too long. Just like the... oh, this is one of my favourite stories. About this old man, this old woman. And they were married for so many years together that when one of them died, the other one died a few days later. Now, natural causes, but they missed each other so much. So they appeared in heaven together. And this angel met them, And the angel took them to this incredible mansion on the cliffs, sea views. And the angel said, because of, you know, you're good people in your life, that, you know, you gave a lot of kindness and charity to others, this is for you, your lifetime reward, your, you know, eternity reward in heaven. Beautiful mansion, just overlooking the cliffs. And the guy saw Tom, one look at that mansion, said, it's a wonderful mansion. I always wanted to live in a place like this, but the council rates must be enormous. And the angel said, look, there is no government up in heaven, no councils. It's for free, okay? Oh, really? Yeah, good, okay. Then he took them inside to have a look. And you wouldn't believe just the furnishings in this house. Just were just amazing. They have these huge LCD TV sets. And about as wide as this room here. And he always liked watching sort of soccer on the TV. And he said, you can watch Liverpool beat Manchester City every time. Because it's heaven, your team always wins. And it's even in the toilet. They showed in the toilet. The toilet bowl was made out of gold. And the little button you press at the top was a diamond. 30-carat diamond. And when he pressed it, what came out wasn't water, was Chanel number 5. And when he went down, and he said, look, this is really expensive stuff. I don't really need this. He said, no, but it's your reward for all your kindness and goodness. But I won't be able to afford the insurance. This is expensive stuff here. And he said, look, you're in heaven. We don't allow thieves and burglars to come up here. It's all for free. Okay, then they took him down to the garage, the triple garage. And in the triple garage, first of all, was this incredibly huge stretch limousine. It was so huge, the stretch limousine, even had a swimming pool in the back. And the second car was an SUV. It would go anywhere. And he said, this is so strong, it can even go into the mountains, it can even go up waterfalls. Up them, not down them. And the last car was a limited edition Lamborghini. Red colour with a sunroof. And the angel said, we always knew you liked fast cars, but you were too old to afford one or even to drive one in your last years of your life. But this is your reward. You can have a Lamborghini. And he said, that's a very nice car, but what's the point of having fast cars in these days? With all these policemen with speed cameras. And he said, what are you talking about? We don't allow police up in heaven. And especially not speed cameras. It doesn't matter if you have an accident, you're already dead. And then it opened the garage doors, and on the opposite side of the road was this immaculate 18-hole golf course. And he said, we knew you liked golf in your life. So we built a golf course right opposite you. And he looked at the big golf course and the big clubhouse and said, look, golf courses like that, you have to know people to be able to be elected as members of the golf course or the golf club. And I just don't know anybody and I can't afford it. I don't know what the fees are. And the angel rolled his eyes again and said, sir, there's no fees at all. You're already a member, not a life member, a death member. Enjoy. And then the angel went away. And as soon as the angel departed, the husband started getting very angry at his wife, shouting at her, screaming at her, swearing at her. And the wife couldn't understand, why are you so angry at me? And he said, because, wife. Because, darling, if it wasn't for all that health food you gave me the last 3 years, I could have been up here years ago. Do you want some health food when you're sick? That's how you overcome the fear of death. Anyway, oh my goodness me, what am I doing here? It's almost finished and still got lots of... what are these questions there? My fault. Praise card. Dear Ajahn, thank you so much for your words of wisdom. You told me to rest. No, to be kind and gentle with my mind, and I am watching becoming naturally still. Yay, well done. Thank you for helping me kindle the care of metta, expressing my loving kindness to all retreatants. Thank you for all of your being, for all of you being you, and just as you are. May you all find peace and happiness. Yay. So it does work. Dear Ajahn Brahm, some people have told me that I have kindness. I can't seem to notice that in myself, so I thought that these people are just being nice. Then more people tell me that I have good heart. What is the reason that we can't notice the kind speech and action that we already have? What happens when people tell you you're miserable and selfish? Then what happens? Do you say, you're wrong? Or do you think, oh, they must be right? A lot of time when people criticize you, you accept it much easier. But when they praise you, you find it difficult to accept. It's our condition. People told me, if someone praises you, just reject it, otherwise you'll get a big head. And then what changed my understanding of that was when I got one of these medals, the John Curtin medal, some years ago. And, you know, it was for three things. He said, for vision, community service, and leadership. And I looked and said, can't be for vision. I have to wear glasses. My vision's not so good. Community service, that's what you do instead of going to jail. So it must be leadership. Okay, fair enough. So... when I went up, you had to give a speech to get this medal from John Curtin University, and I said, well, thank you very much. I was very quite surprised. I don't know if I really deserve it, and there's probably many more people in the Perth area or in West Australia who deserve it much more than I do. But thank you. And, oh, and first of all, I wouldn't be able to do this without the help of all my friends and supporters. And that's a speech I gave. And then the next year, I was invited back again when somebody else was getting this award, and it was a brilliant person. It's Professor Joski, that's right, from, what was he, Charlie Gardner's? No, he was at, yeah, Charlie Gardner's Hospital. And he did a wonderful thing by kicking a few people out of their rooms and turning over to an alternative therapy centre where you can get sort of Reiki, you can get massage, homeopathy, foot massage, anything, as long as it was weird. And it was actually sponsored at the time by Brown's Dairy. And it was anyone who had cancer treatment could go into those rooms and just get cared for half an hour for free. It didn't matter if it's Reiki or foot massage. Someone was actually spending time with you, really caring for you. And I knew that just that would be very powerful, and it was. And so he got the John Curtin Medal for this, for risking his career to help people. So when he gave his speech, he said, well, there's many more people in the community who do much more work than I do, and I couldn't have done this without, you know, the help of all my friends, but thank you anyway. And I heard that, and I said, that was my speech. And it becomes everyone's speech when anyone gives you some award and really thanks you. And I realised just how wrong I was, because I was really inspired by him. I thought it was a wonderful thing he did. And I told him afterwards, no, you deserve that. And I realised that maybe, just maybe, maybe I deserve my medal. And it was hard to accept praise. But nowadays, I realise, yeah, someone praises me. So yes, well done, yes, I deserve that. If someone praises you, you've done an excellent job, Leha, for your first retreat you managed. Well done. How do you react? Do you deserve that?
Yes.
Very good.
We know how hard it is. It's sometimes embarrassing. People say, well done. And you say, yeah, I deserve that. And what I've found in my life, if you accept praise, you don't get a big head. You get a big tummy. Be careful, Leha, you get a big tummy. Venerable, are we here or is it just an illusion? Respect. Are you, we here? Well, you were here. Are you still here? You can answer that question yourself. Venerable sir. Okay. If a dancing cow is a milkshake, what... If a dancing bull is a milkshake, what is a sitting bull? And they got here chocolate, of course. I don't know. Oh, boy. If reference... Okay, here we go. Oh, yeah, in reference to the Ajahn Ganaha story, where Ajahn Chah asked if anyone had made an end of the defilements. Number one, how did he know to ask? This is a story. Sometimes, you know, we have fun and games, and sometimes have some very deep stories. And sitting in Ajahn Chah's, underneath his hut, and he started to ask all his senior monks, his most senior monks, you know, have you ended all the defilements yet? Are you an arahant? And his most senior monk said, not yet. He went down the line of all these monks. And then when he got to this monk, Ajahn Ganaha, he said, have you ended defilements yet? He said, yes. And everyone went quiet. And he was claiming to be fully enlightened. And so Ajahn Chah said, come upstairs. They went upstairs. And of course, no one ever knows what was said upstairs. But that was the event there. How did he know to ask? How did Ajahn Chah know how to ask? Ajahn Chah could read minds. He knew what was going on. Why could he not tell? I think maybe it was because he just wanted some of the other monks to know what was going on. Why did he tell Lumpur Ganaha to develop metta? Isn't it automatic? It is actually not automatic. Sometimes when the Buddha became enlightened, what did he do? He just sat there. He needed, not Mahapajapati, he needed this god, what's it called? Brahmasahampati, Sahampati, to say, please teach for the happiness and benefit of all beings. Show some kindness. It was Sahampati who encouraged our Buddha to have the compassion to teach. Otherwise, Siddhartha Gautama would have been what we call a Pajeka Buddha, quiet Buddha, fully enlightened, but not teaching at all. I know that sometimes that Brahma Sahampati, I don't know why they call it Brahma Sahampati, because Brahma means like a god. And so there's one monk who had a great sense of humour. He said, without Brahma Sahampati, you know, the god Sahampati, asking the Buddha, there would be no Buddhism. So thank God for Buddhism. But Sahampati wasn't a god, he was a non-returner. And there's more stuff about Sahampati in the suttas. And Sahampati was a monk with the Buddha under the former Buddha Kassapa. They were monks together. And that's why Sahampati said that we were monks in a previous life together. So you know, I'm a non-returner, now you become a Buddha. Please teach. They were good friends, previous life. But he needed to actually to ask, otherwise he would have done it. Do arahants need to be asked before they stick around to teach, like the Buddha? What if nobody asks? If nobody asks, often they become a Pajeka Buddha. Pajeka Buddha means a silent Buddha. How does the mind differ from consciousness? Are these two terms interchangeable?
They can be, but you don't say consciousness, you say consciousnesses. Ask any psychologists, psychiatrists, whatever. There's 6 different types of consciousness. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and knowing. And they're totally different. But what happens is when you see something, the data of seeing is known by the mind consciousness. When you hear something, what you hear could be known by the mind. So you know you heard. You know you saw. And because that's the only real thing which registers, sight plus mind consciousness, sound plus mind consciousness, smell plus mind consciousness, taste plus mind consciousness, and touch plus mind consciousness. That's what we think is conscious awareness. That gives seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching a sense of sameness. There's something similar between seeing and even feeling. And it's the mind consciousness which comes in and gives it the sense of similarity. But it's not a continuous flow of one type of consciousness. It's sight, disappears, knowing, disappears. Maybe sight again, and then disappears, knowing, disappears. It may appear smooth, like the old movies might appear smooth, but if you look at the celluloid film, you find out there's one shot, another shot, another shot, many stills moving very fast. That is our stream of consciousness. So if you say mind consciousness, the 6 consciousness, and the mind, obviously they are the same, but not the other consciousnesses. And the only real way you can see that is by experiencing, here we go again, jhanas. Because in jhanas, that's pure consciousness. The other senses have disappeared for a while. You're not seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. It's just this mind. Once you know what that is, you can see just how it always comes in. And that actually shows what the consciousness is. That's why we even say, for those people who know your Buddhism, the 5 khandhas. What's the last of the 5 khandhas? Oh good, somebody said it right. Consciousness is. Not just consciousness. If you say consciousness is, given a good translation, it changes just the whole meaning of the 5 khandhas and you see much deeper into what it's trying to tell you. Dear Ajahn, please convey our thanks to those who created and maintain the gardens in Jhana Grove. They are a delight. I think most of the gardening is done by nature. But Annie also does a lot. Annie, she's not here today anyway. But dear Ajahn, please correct me if I've not understood it right. The Buddha recommended insight meditation and samatha to be practiced together and it leads to jhana. Basically, yeah, you can focus one on the front, but the other one always comes behind. Lady Sayadaw reduced the emphasis on samatha and focus on insight to encourage lay people to practice meditation. Insight meditation leads to mindfulness. It eventually leads to everything as well. So many people do insight meditation. There's many have told me that they're doing insight meditation and they get quite still and peaceful. They see these beautiful nimittas come up. Mm-hmm. And they're told by their teacher, no, don't do that. But this happens. So even if you're doing insight, you still get nimittas coming up, beautiful states of mind, because it's all the same. Path to ultimate liberation is through jhana. Mindfulness does not lead one to jhana. Therefore, insight alone does not lead to ultimate liberation. Yes and no. But what happens is you start with insight and the jhanas will come up eventually. You can't stop them. It's a natural process. It's not up to you. It's not what you do. You let go. You put things down and things happen. So whether you want it or not, on the insight meditation retreats, you bliss out and get into jhanas. It's when the teachers say, don't do that, do this. They don't know what they're talking about. So it doesn't matter. You can do an insight retreat if you want. It's not really an insight retreat. Jhana's coming in the back. In Wisdom of Silence, you state, oh boy, I'm in trouble. You state that rebirth can occur between all species, not just human beings, but animals to humans, humans to animals. Why would a human seek rebirth in the animal species? I know many people. There's one guy I remember, I was quite surprised. He said when he dies, he wants to be reborn as a dog. I never heard that before. So I asked him, well, why do you want to be reborn as a dog for? He said, look, think about it. Be logical. Dogs don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. Dogs have no stress. Dogs, they get fed, they don't have to cook any food for themselves. They just get the food from the owners. They don't like the food, and the owners will get them more food. They have free health care. All they've got to do is actually just go for a walk in the morning to take their owner for a walk, that's all. And they can sleep around all day. Imagine that alive, you can just lay quietly in a corner somewhere most of the day, go for a walk in the morning, and then just, you know, be kind to you, just wag your tail every now and again, and you get very nice food. Pretty good lifestyle, isn't it? And he said, compared to the stress of your life, all the hard work you have to do, would you not mind being a dog? In Australia or some other nice places where people really love their dogs. But then I said, that's when I told him that in Australia, if you're a dog, in the first months of your life, you get taken to the vet to get de-sexed. And I remember just telling him that, and oh my goodness, I never thought of that. I don't want to be a dog. Poor fellow. But anyway, sometimes it's just not of your choice. Sometimes it just happens. Humans have a bad track record for care and respect to animals. Not all humans, but a lot. I would be afraid of being an animal at the mercy of some humans. But if you're like a dog or a cat, you know, with, say, people in Australia, it's not a bad life. The Buddha told of our direct path to enlightenment. Will you please teach us this path or method? Eightfold Path. That's a direct path to enlightenment. Honestly, no joke. The Buddha said it has to be the Eightfold Path. Dear Ajahn, you were unwell this morning, weren't you? How do you feel now? I wasn't. I was unwell this morning. Not me. No self, so it couldn't be me. Unwell this morning. I've got no memory of being unwell this morning. What did I do which made you think I was unwell? I was actually fine. Maybe you know something which I don't know. When I say, please don't laugh when I say stupid things, you're encouraging me. You're encouraging me again. When I sit for meditation, my breath is right there, ready for my full attention, but I haven't gone through the first two stages of the meditation process. If I try to go back, my breath is still the most dominant sensation. What do I do? Stay with your breath. You know, sometimes that. Have you ever made sort of, you know, noodles, you know, from rice, and actually to be able to make them into noodles? Have you ever seen people making spaghetti? This is with the dough and just twirling it around and stretching it to make spaghetti. But these days, you can get from Coles, you can get, you know, pre-made spaghetti. Just add hot water, or you get instant noodles, mama, or nasi goreng, or whatever it's called, anyway. So you get instant stuff these days. If you've got instant noodles, you don't need to go through all that process of making it from scratch. It's the same if you've got the breath there, it's ready to be used, then just stay with the breath. You don't need to do the beginning parts at all. Instant jhanas, just add water. Can you please give us a morning talk on deep Dhamma? Oh, yeah, I've been doing that the last few mornings. We'll see what happens. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Would you kindly elaborate on the five hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment? No. Yeah, I will, but not tonight, because that's a big subject. Director, why do thoughts or memories reverberate in the mind? How can I let go of these? Because you give them importance. If they're really important, of course, you know, you grab hold of them and you give them prominence. Oh, this story I was going to say earlier is of this professor who came to his lecture, and he had a big jar. And from his briefcase, he never said anything to his students. The students didn't know what he was on about. From his jar, he picked out these stones and put them in the jar, one after the other, until he could get no more in his jar. And then he asked his students, "Is the jar full?" "Yeah, it's full." "What a stupid question. Stupid full." And he smiled, and from his briefcase, he had a bag of smaller stones. Because there were smaller stones, he managed to get many of those smaller stones in the gap between the rocks. Is the jar full now, when you can get no more smaller stones in? And they all looked at him and said, "Nah, I'll probably find something else to put in there." And then he poured out a bag of sand. He put the sand on the top, shook the jar, and much of the sand found its way between the gaps between the rocks and the small stones. "Is it full?" They all said no. He got the jar of water and poured the water in. He said, "What is this trying to prove to you?" And one of the students put their hand up. It was a business school. He said, "Doesn't matter how busy we are, we can always do something more." He said, "No. The meaning of this is you want to put the big rocks in, they have to go in first. The most important things in your life." So talk about priorities. Get the important things in there first. The other things can come in later. And on this retreat, what's the most important thing? Peace, silence. Not the thoughts. So leave the thoughts till later. You can fit them in afterwards if you really want to. But put peace in there first of all. Then you find that it's easy to thoughts and memories. The memories aren't important on this retreat. So if you want to put them in last, but put the big rocks in of silence and peace and happiness. And also one of the most important big rocks for you is like rest. Have some time off and just enjoy these moments here. It's a beautiful, beautiful place, Jhana Grove. So don't spoil it by doing too much. After a nice meditation, I notice that the mind is always positive, happy in nature, yeah. If I'm lucky, sometimes there are no thoughts at all. Yay. What are the causes that will make this type of mind state last longer? Is meditate more. It's the only thing you can do. It's because you do have energy when you meditate. So if you're really tired and you find yourself getting negative, see if you can find a nice little place somewhere in your house and do some meditation. Or in your place of work. That's why I really like the United States in one sense. If you're working, you can always go to the toilet any time of day. Only they don't call it toilet in the United States, they call it restroom. I don't know why they called it that, but I thought it's a wonderful name. Then go there for a rest so you don't get so tired. Dear Ajahn Brahm, may you live healthy and long life. No. I do not follow orders. You see how people really want to control you? People all over the world would like to listen to your Dhamma with jokes. They've listened to it already. How many times have you listened to all those jokes? A long time. What's another joke I can tell tonight? Do you want to... Sorry? Any good joke which I haven't said for a while? Oh, yeah, this is actually not a joke. But this is actually Ajahn Chah's great wisdom, because he was telling some people once, he said he predicted that in the future that people will run out of money, run out of paper to print banknotes. and they'd run out of metal to print coins. So I said, what would they use when they got no paper and no metal to create money? They'd have to choose something else. And so you suggested that in the future the governments would use these little pellets of chicken poo as money. So you go to work and they give you a big bag of chicken poo as your salary. And you stuff it in your pockets. And you go to the bank and the ATM would be an automatic poo machine, an APM. And you'd really fight over who had the most poo in their account. And IMF would become the International Manure Fund. The Finance Ministry, the Treasurer would become the Poo Minister. What's the difference between chicken poo and dollar notes? Hey, no dollar notes anymore, are there? Well, $10 notes. What's the difference between chicken poo and $10 notes? Actually, nothing. It's only the value which people give it. So imagine a time when the donation box, you just put chicken poo in it. And AJ Chow said that, and anyway. Was that the one you meant? Yeah, okay, very good, okay. I basically have a healthy and long life. I'm 69 years, is that not long enough? How many times are we taught just to have few desires, no wants? So Ajahn Brahm, 69 years is enough. Now you can just go off and be peaceful. Would that be a nice idea? And so sometimes you think, all these other young monks, remember those great talks they gave at the beginning of the COVID time? And if I'm always here, I always get to give all the talks, and so the young monks don't learn. When the sun is out, you cannot see the moon. When the moon is out, you cannot see the stars. So is it the time the sun and the moon have to disappear to let the sun, let the stars shine forth? No? No. Same time, we'd like to thank Leha, Christina and Sudama for their hard work to run this retreat. We miss Bianca a lot. Anyway, a new group is doing their best. We're doing a pretty good job. Many, many thanks for them. May the Triple Gem bless them too. Excellent. See, so we've got the new people coming in. If you always told Bianca, may you live long and happily and be really healthy so they can always serve us. It's a bit selfish, isn't it? Ajahn Brahm lived long. It was a bit selfish, wasn't it? Ajahn, my cheeks hurt from laughing at all the jokes during last night's session. You will get used to it. I was born a Buddhist but didn't know much about Buddhism apart from the basics, good and bad karma. 4 months ago, I arrived at the monastery and was offered the rare opportunity to stay for the Rains retreat thanks to COVID. During this period, I began to absorb and learn so much, not only on meditation, but also compassion and kindness towards myself and others. This allows me to live life with more ease and letting go, except for your hurting cheeks. I would like to extend my gratitude towards the Sangha, the monks, the nuns, the laymen, laywomen, and the kangaroos as well, and all the birds who have continuously contributed to the flourishing of Buddhism, especially here in WA. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you. I deserve that. Could you talk more about the difference between love and attachment? What does it mean if you love someone you can't, and love someone and you can let them go? How can lay people form more enlightened relationships? If you really love someone, do you really love them? You want them to be happy? Or is your love, I love you to be close to me. I love how you make me feel. And I love just, the convenience, the warmth I feel when you're around. That's not real love, is it? It's not wishing them well. It's, what they can give to you and provide to you. Real love is opening the door of your heart to someone, whatever they do. It's called unconditional love. Unconditional means I just love you. I really want you to be happy. You can disappear and go all over the world, but I still love you. You don't need to be near, you can be far, you don't need to like me and love me. And that unconditional love, that's not the real love. It's really strange sometimes with the idea of love. You have, like, people, they have a partner in life. And their partner, they spend such a long time choosing the right person. And they sometimes, just like, you know, buying a car, they do a test drive, go out together, trying to get to know one another. And they spend so much effort choosing one another. But still, you know, they find it hard to maintain that love to their partner. But then you have a kid. You don't know who comes into your life as a child, boy or a girl. Sometimes they can drive you a bit crazy sometimes, but you love them forever. What's the difference between a parent's love to a child? If they don't choose. You know, they choose to have one, but they don't know really what's going to come out. It's a bit of a lottery. But they'd always love their children. But when it comes to our partner, it's different. One of the reasons is, and my suggestion here is, your love for a kid, you love them, you have no expectations. You want them to do well in life, but they don't have to. But your partner, you have so many expectations of what they should be. So much so that you spend so much time as a monk doing marriage counselling. I thought being a monk, I'd get out of that. And what was it? This couple came up recently and telling about all the things wrong with their husband. He was there. And then my husband, I said, what about her? And he told me all the things wrong with her. I said, you know, you've both got the same amount of faults, so you're a match. That was logical to me, but they didn't get it. Anyway, last question. Yeah, oh no, two last questions. Thank you so much for doing what you're doing, not doing being. Much gratitude and blessing your way, absolute love for your way of teaching. As you like bad jokes, I have one for you. Yeah. Why don't eggs tell jokes? Answer, turn around this page. Oh, okay. I'll tell you around the wrong way. Why don't eggs tell jokes? Any idea? The answer is, they crack each other up. That's not bad. Dear Ajahn, may you please say something about the wisdom aspect that allows letting go to happen? That's a good question. Why is the feedback that there is... What is the feedback that there is letting go happening? I'll do this question tomorrow because it's getting late. It's 9:30 now. So I've got two questions. About the five hindrances, seven facts of enlightenment, and always more about letting go and the wisdom part which allows it to happen. So that will be done tomorrow. Otherwise, I'll be keeping you up way past your bedtime. And in the morning, when we do the chanting, I'll be doing the chanting alone. Okay, so at the end of the talks, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, have a wonderful night's sleep.